This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to a special live episode. As I mentioned last time, I will be presenting at this year's Intelligent Speech Conference. If you are hearing this when it comes out, Intelligent Speech is just a few days away on Saturday, February 8th. We have a ton of great independent podcasters presenting on a wide range of historical and less historical topics, and every presentation, hypothetically, ends in a live question and answer session. This year's theme is deception. So we've got Otto English, the author of books like Fake Heroes and Fake History, the Fake History Hunter podcast, Wesley Livesey from History of the Great War and History of the Second World War podcasts. We also have past guests of Secret Wars, like Aurora from Swords, Sorcery, and Socialism, Roberto from Tsar Power, and all of the rest will be there, Bree and Fry from Pontifax will be there, Nick and Bailey from Totalis Jeffianis, they will also be there. Not to mention, if you like Secret Wars, this year will feature a surprisingly American History of Deception-heavy lineup. I will personally be appearing in four time slots. I am on the religion panel to talk about how Zoroastrianism was affected by colonialism, the pen names panel to talk about ancient anonymous authors, and Call My Bluff to play historical Two Truths and a Lie. I will also be giving a full presentation on the lies of the Persian king Darius the Great. I will be doing my absolute best to leave time for questions at all of these. Strictly speaking, the Q&A portion is planned around each panel, but I guess there's nothing stopping you from asking more Secret Warsy questions. The whole event will be available for rewatch for a whole week after it ends if you buy your tickets now. Go to intelligentspeechonline.com to get yours, and tune in this Saturday. Again, that's February 8th at 10 o'clock a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, and you can get your tickets from intelligentspeechonline.com. If that isn't enough to get you interested, today's episode is actually the audio recording from my presentation last year, to give you a sense of what you can expect. It is about ancient communes and proto-communism. You'll like it. There was a PowerPoint presentation, and you can find a link to the YouTube video in the description of this episode. One last time, intelligentspeechonline.com. This Saturday, February 8th at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Buy your tickets. Watch it live or stream it later, but if you come on the day of, I will be doing multiple Q&As, as will many of the other presenters. I will see you then. Thank you all for listening. I hope to hear from you this Saturday at Intelligent Speech. If not, the Almost War with Canada series will continue the next day. Until then, throw off the shackles of your imperial hegemon and convince your local monarch to become a communist. Hello, everyone. As said, I'm Trevor Cully, host of The History of Persia, and today I'm talking about communes, cults, and caliphs, not necessarily in that order. Now, if you've been following along at home, then I'm jumping way far ahead in the timeline from the accursed Alexander rampaging through Central Asia. And if you're just now hearing me for the first time, hello, historyofpersiapodcast.com, like, subscribe, etc., etc. We are talking about some proto-revolutionary movements in ancient Iran. And to set the stage, we're starting around 484 to 488 BC, or CE, I got to get used to that. The place is the Oxus River, the modern Sir Daria, and it's on the border between the Sassanid Persian Empire and the Hephthalite Empire, a multi-ethnic, multilingual kingdom that spread out of the modern Xinjiang province in China to conquer a ton of Central Asian territory. Off in the west, the Eastern Roman Emperor Anastasius was busy sorting out a series of revolts and the collapse of his Western counterpart, while the Sassanids were fighting on and off wars over here in Central Asia. At this point, King Peroz I is killed in battle, as were four of his sons and brothers, along with most of their army. So the empire is off to a great start here. This left a bit of a conundrum for the ruling class of the empire. If you're familiar with the much earlier Achaemenid Persians, this won't be a unique story. The Sassanid dynasty were not direct successors to the Achaemenids, but more the Arsacid dynasty of Parthia, and like the Parthians, the Sassanids operated as an elective monarchy. So they usually picked from the same dynasty, but they had their choice of any of the brothers or sons who were still in play. And in this case, they chose Balash, one of Peroz's brothers, mostly off the back of a noble named Sukra, who was the most powerful of the nobles at the time, and he was left to raise a new army and finish the war with the Hephthalites while Balash got settled in on the throne. That worked great until humanity's favorite pastime, religious zealotry, just had to go and get itself involved. At this point, the Zoroastrian central priesthood was especially powerful, and Sukra in particular was a conservative zealot. But Balash was a very mild religious ruler and was perfectly happy to allow Christian influence to spread in the empire. So when the Christian Armenians rebelled, Balash agreed to a peace settlement that allowed the Christian kings to crack down on Zoroastrianism in their territory. This irritated the conservatives back in Persia, and they staged a coup, assassinated Balash, and installed his nephew, the 15-year-old Kavad I. Kavad did his time as a minor, with Sukra ruling as regent, but when he was 20, he ordered Sukra step down, imprisoned the noble, realized that he was still powerful in prison, and then murdered Sukra. This obviously irritated other members of the nobility, because if the most powerful of their lot wasn't safe, then which of them could expect Kavad to be nice to them? But Kavad didn't really care. He needed to get things running his way. And so far, this is all standard ancient imperial stuff. Scheming nobles, religious conflict, the works. But in the background of all of this, there's another series of events playing out. The Zoroastrian... Sorry, my dog's going nuts. The Zoroastrian versus Christian conflict was not the only religious tension in the empire. And we are about 200 years into an ongoing process of the Zoroastrian priesthood consolidating authority and pushing their kings to persecute Christians, Buddhists, and a native-born movement called the Manichaeans, as well as heterodox Zoroastrians. And just because some people might not be familiar with it, what is Zoroastrianism? It operates on a creed of good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. It was founded around 1200 BC by the prophet Zarathustra, and prior to Islam, it was the dominant religion in Iran and the surrounding area. It's still around today, about 200,000 practitioners worldwide, and it's often called the first monotheistic religion, but it does get a bit more complicated. They had their creator god, Ahura Mazda, and then a series of minor divinities called Yazads, which were kind of gods, kind of angels, and they all operated on a principle of righteous order in the universe called Asha. And they were opposed by generally evil counterparts. And an important part of this system of righteous order is free will. That is an inherent good in the universe. And that's kind of the answer to why evil is allowed to exist, because even powerful spirits are allowed to choose whether to be good or bad. This became a part of Iranian politics over time and led to some schisms in how to interpret different parts of the religion, which brings us to Zaradust E. Krosak. He was a Zoroastrian religious leader in a small town called Pasa, just outside of Shiraz in modern Iran. Zaradust also gets us to one of the main issues with the people I'm talking about for the first half or so of this presentation. We have approximately zero contemporary sources of any sort and have to rely on medieval Muslim Arabic authors, the Persian epic, the Shahnameh, and some very hostile, very late Zoroastrian documents. We know almost nothing about Zaradust specifically, aside from some of the basics of his message. We don't even really know when he lived. What we do know is that his message included equity and equality based on Zoroastrian principles, at least for men. Generally, the sources agree that Zaradust saw both women and property as sources of envy, anger, hatred, and greed in society, but also that the Zoroastrian god, Ahura Mazda, had created all men as equals, and as equals, they should hold women and property in common without any formal ownership. It's important to remember that almost all of the sources here were hostile and written in a very different Islamicized version of Iranian culture, which leaves historians trying to piece together the broad statements like this with more subtle references to explain what systems the Zaradustis actually had in mind. The 19th century German scholar Theodor Noldeke arrived at the most plausible option. Zaradust resented the polygamous harems of the nobility and class restrictions on marriage, and he wanted to allow women to marry outside of their class and eliminate all sense of hereditary property. This is backed up by a Zoroastrian commentary, which condemned Zaradust for tracing genealogy through the mother and specifically allowing cross-class marriages. Zaradust also seemingly preached in favor of vegetarianism and against the use of violence unless absolutely necessary, so conditional pacifism. There's not much information about their opinions on slavery one way or the other, but most sources suggest that to participate in their communal lifestyle required conversion, and since Sassanid law forbade enslavement of Zoroastrians, it was kind of a moot point. In his own time, whenever that might have been, Zaradust's teachings remained largely confined to small communities with little impact on the empire as a whole. But shortly after Kavad became Shah, one of Zaradust's students or adherents started growing a following in the major cities, including the Sassanid home capital of Istakhr. This was Mazdak, the son of Bamdad. And he was busy preaching an evolved version of the Zaradusti message that was very popular among the commoners and nobility alike. Right when Kavad was looking for somebody to lend him some legitimacy. So he invited Mazdak to court. The jury's out on whether or not Kavad was a true believer or just a cynical politician, but we do know that many of his nobles were converts and that Kavad instituted reforms as suggested by Mazdak, while individuals went further, living communally, holding property in common, redistributing their own lands, and in some sense or another, probably sharing women, however we choose to interpret that, and I'll get there. The big reforms were water access and grain stores being hoarded by the nobility had to be turned over to public use, especially because Persia was in the middle of a drought during these years of Kavad's reign. Mazdak implored him not to slaughter cattle until the end of their natural lives. Again, there's that vegetarian element. And these years were basically as peaceful as ancient empires ever got. There were no major international conflicts going on. On a state level, full communal ownership was just impractical, unenforceable, and would have been dangerously unpopular. It would have prompted massive revolts by the landowning classes. And there wasn't really the infrastructure to communicate that over such a huge area. But it was still kind of the guiding light of Mazdakite reforms under Kavad's rule. The role of women in Mazdakism is sometimes treated as pure polemic, but it's a bit more complicated. The Denkard is extremely concerned with how this muddled genealogy and allowed people of all classes to intermix, and how that would affect transmission of property from father to son. But there was actually an institution called the Stura in ancient Iran, which was a sort of interim marriage where it was acceptable for a man to have children with another man's wife to make sure that he had an heir. It's possible that Mazdak or Zaradust before him generalized this for all of their communes as a way of breaking out of that hereditary system of inheritance. The much later Kurami movement, which I'll get to near the end, was also associated with Mazdakism and had a system that the Arabs identified as communal access to women, which was simply that marriage did not grant a man total control over his wife's sexuality. Kurami women were free to engage with other partners. Though it's a later movement, many modern historians wonder if, rather than being the descendants of Mazdakites, Mazdak and his followers were taking the Kurami idea as it existed in their time and applying it to the world as a whole. A more liberatory version of marriage than previously existed. But this gets to where Zoroastrian theology is kind of fascinating to me. From the time we're talking about, mainstream Zoroastrians have remembered Mazdak as one of their arch heretics and a force of evil and corruption. But like many failed movements in history, it was a legitimate position in its time. Even an extremely limited reading of Zoroastrian scripture makes total anarchism, society without any hierarchy at all, functionally impossible because of a concept called the Far, similar to European ideas of divine right, but it's fairly nebulous. Some people or a single person are blessed with the far, the right to lead, and in antiquity that was usually the king. But there's nothing in Zoroastrian scripture that says it was limited to anybody of a class or even an individual person at any given time. But by the Sassanid period, Zoroastrian belief did enshrine class into the moral fiber of the universe as part of Asha. By this time, there was a system of estates similar to early modern Europe, but with four classes rather than three. And of course, you have the great king, the king of kings himself, who is kind of above all this. And immediately below him was the priests of priests, the high priest for their society. And they sort of exist outside of this structure. But beneath them, you have the priesthood, the nobility and the warrior class, the vast bulk of the population as peasant farmers, and at the very bottom of this hierarchy, merchant artisans, the kind of people who were encountering Mazdakism in the cities where it was gaining popularity. And these were treated by the priesthood, for obvious reasons based on that pyramid, as part of divinely sanctioned order. But there's nothing in their scriptures that actually sets up this class structure. So Mazdak and Zaradust had enough wiggle room to argue that they were not, in fact, part of the order of the universe. This class structure could be ignored. And this also ran up against a concept called Zervanism, a movement that was popular among the high priesthood at the time. It's poorly remembered, even more so than Mazdakism, but it altered Zoroastrian theology to state that good and evil both stemmed from Zervan, the god of time. And by making a sort of neutral arbiter the source of all creation, it was used to eliminate the role of free will in Asha. So you could have these four estates and just say, well, you were born here, that's the way that time ordained it, and kind of get out of the ability to choose that was so central in earlier periods. And of course, all of this was very unpopular. We get to the backlash. If you've studied revolutions in any way, even if that's just listening to Mike Duncan's podcast or even History of Rome before that, then you know the ruling class rarely takes kindly to radical reformers who want to redistribute their property. So in 496, a cabal of nobles, high-ranking priests, and other leaders got together, marched into Kavad's palace, took him prisoner, and installed his brother Jamasp on the throne. Jamasp wouldn't execute his brother, so Kavad was taken to a prison called, and I swear this is true, the Fortress of Oblivion. But he still had allies, especially within the Mazdakite movements, and one of those nobles was able to sneak in with a care package containing some servants' clothes, and together they broke out, grabbed a couple of horses, raced clear across all of Iran, and fled to the Hephthalites, who, as you might remember, actually set all of this off in the first place. While he was hiding out there, Kavad married a Hephthalite princess and used his new position to get the king to give him an army. So in 499, he crossed back into Iran with this Hephthalite army behind him, kicked his brother out of power, and retook the throne. But he realized that he couldn't keep the Mazdakite reforms going. He had to mellow out or he would lose power, and self-preservation won in the end. So he eased up taxes, creating a middle class of small landholders. But for the most part, the communal aspects, free reign over grain and water, that was all over. But he didn't go after Mazdak. He let him continue preaching. He just didn't come back to the palace until the high priesthood got their claws into Kavad's son. This was Prince Khosro, who eventually became known as Khosro Anushirvan, the Blessed Soul. And he got this name in part because he led the crackdown against the Mazdakites. Kavad, once again, going for self-preservation, allowed a massive pogrom against his former friends, and Mazdak himself was invited to the palace to find thousands of his followers buried upside down in the dirt before being hung by a noose and shot full of arrows, a particularly brutal form of execution. But then we skip forward. Several centuries, the Sassanid Empire has a war with the Romans, they decline, the Arab Caliphates invade, and now all of a sudden everything is ruled by the Abbasid Caliphate. It's the middle of the 9th century AD, and we meet the Karamis, which technically refers to a single group of a widespread collection of peoples, but because the Karamis are the most famous, they're the catch-all. Officially, they had converted to Shia Islam very early on, but this was very surface level. They were usually accused of being crypto-Zoroastrians and often as not of being Mazdakites. They were insular communities that held property in common, practiced a form of open sexuality or communal marriage, as I described earlier, also preached conditional pacifism, practiced vegetarianism, and several groups were even called Parsis, meaning Persians, or Mazdakis, very possibly a reference to Mazdak. And the most famous of them was Babak Khorramdin. The primary biography about his life is lost from the Middle Ages, but what we do know is that he came from a poor family in eastern Azerbaijan. His father was killed when he was young, and he and his mother were given refuge by a Karami community. When Babak was 12, he was taken in by a communal leader and kind of became his apprentice. He absorbed a lot of the Karami lifestyle and social values, and was a witness when his mentor was killed in battle against the Arabs who were trying to push in and kind of consolidate their control over this region in the mountains. This pushed Babak over the edge. He was tired of seeing his people being continually pushed further and further to the margins of society by the Abbasids, and he started preparing his people for war. They took control of a fortress on Mount Bad and began raiding Arab supply trains through the mountainous region. They were trying to fight a war of independence to keep the invaders out of their business once and for all. They used guerrilla tactics, ambushing and plundering caravans, raiding little military depots, and building up a stockpile and experience before having to fight the caliphate directly. This lasted for 14 years. Before a new caliph came to power and had a different approach. The previous ruler, Al-Ma'mun, had just kind of treated these guys as a highland irritation. But tensions were growing in Armenia against the Byzantine Romans, and the new caliph, Al-Mutasim, wanted to get the Karamis out of the way. So this time, the Abbasids turned to stage hit-and-run attacks against the Karamis, taking prisoners and collecting information about the enemy troop movements. Finally, they made this big show of transporting the pay for all of their soldiers through Karami territory, and Babak took the bait. He was ambushed on the road by Arabs using the same guerrilla tactics that he had been using for years, and was forced to retreat to his mountain fortress, only for spies to let the Arabs in and to kill Babak himself. Some of the Karamis escaped, fleeing to the Roman Empire, including one who took on a new name of Theophobos, fear of God, when converting to Christianity. Interpret that as the fear of God as a religious positive, or he doesn't really like the Christian God. Either works, and both are kind of valid. In the aftermath, the Karami way of life was incompatible and alien to the ruling class, and this antagonism led to multiple series of conflicts and rebellions and pogroms until the lifestyle was kind of stamped out. But they didn't just vanish. As late as the 12th century, a Karami community called the Parsis were still living in Azerbaijan, and many aspects of their lifestyle persist in groups even today. The Kurds and Yazidis both have distinct cultural identities in the same region and carry on some similar practices in their communities.
The same region became a hub of Sufi Islam, which, although more Islamic, still shares some of the same practices. And the Kizilbash, a sect of Shiism, emerged in the same area and has even been described as the spiritual successor of the Karamis. I think it's interesting to note that the same region became a stronghold of the Tuda party in Iran during the 20th century, but I can't find any direct references to explain that. Yes, they were a communist party. Sorry about that. So just the last thing to note, were they communist? Not really. Were they anarchist? Not really. But you could sort of view the Mazdakites as a state-centered version of the same of their practices, and the Karamis as the kind of decentralized version where they just want to be their own communities. But all of this is still this reaction against hoarded private property and resources 1,000 years before modern communism. And that's it.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
All right. Well, thank you, Trevor. We have a couple things that I think in the chat that I would like you to ask you to elaborate on. Going back to the multi-level social structure that you talked about, could you clarify if the peasant farmers were landowners? And while obviously it's known that some cultures definitely don't have a whole lot of respect for merchants, why were the peasant farmers above the artisans?
Right. So when referring to the peasants in this case, this means the farming class that's not landowners. Most of the land at this point was controlled by the nobility who acted as landlords, not unlike medieval Europe. And the difference between the artisans and the peasants is largely due to how late urbanization really came to Iran. That really only came around the time of Alexander the Great's conquests, when cities really started building up. And that meant that there was already an ingrained sense of the agriculturalist as more ideal than this kind of more foreign idea of merchants and artisans.
All right. I'm curious to hear more about the origins of Zoroastrianism, especially in this context of such an early monotheistic religion. Can you speak to sort of what it grew out of?
Yes. So Zoroastrianism really starts with just a reform of the existing Iranian pagan society at around 1200 BC. It is viewed as the first revelatory religion, where a god is supposedly communicating directly with the prophet and saying, this is the proper religion. And it was taking kind of some of the elements and some of the gods of a subset of that early Iranian culture and promoting them as the right way against other gods in the same culture who were worshipped by groups antagonistic to that original Zoroastrian community. So those other gods were characterized as Daiva, which eventually came to mean equivalent to demons.
Is the name Mazdak related to the god Ahura Mazda's name, linguistically?
Yeah, absolutely. And Zaradust and the Zaradustis are, also related to Zoroaster. Theophoric names, names based on the names of gods, were really common in ancient Iran. It's where you get Mithridates, and Bahram is just the straight up the name of a god. There wasn't a taboo on it the way there is in some other cultures.
Hmm. So in the session with So You Think You Can Rule Persia's hosts, you asked the question about which could have been kings would have done better than the people who actually ruled. So I'm wondering about your answer to that.
The part of me that roots for the Persians will always feel like anybody who wasn't Alexander the Great would have been better. In this case, I do think Cyrus the Younger, the Achaemenid prince who rebelled against his brother and got the story of Xenophon and the 10,000 Greek mercenaries, would have been a much better position for the empire to be in. He was on really good terms with Sparta, and would have probably kept the Persians out of a lot of the distracting wars they got into in Greece. Given how long everybody else in his family lived, he probably would have provided a lot more consistency in rulers leading up to when the Macedonians started to get more powerful, which the empire could have used at the time, to say the least.
Were buildings typically named things like House of Oblivion? Was it named that for any particular reason? And what else do we know about that particular building?
Great question. There are other places with kind of similar names from Sassanid Iran, usually associated with some religious or historical figure or concept, the Prison of Solomon or the Throne of Jamshid were names for other sites, but we don't know much about that Fortress of Oblivion in particular. It's referenced in a couple of different texts as a place in Khuzestan, but nothing is ever really described about it for why it was so imposing.
Imagine if they'd known about the oubliette that you get in European castles. Tell us about your research process.
Oh, sure. For this or the podcast, because they're fairly different.
Well, let's talk about for this session then.
So for this, I had the good luck of having written about the Mazdakites before, but it really comes down to, initially in the first few things I wrote, finding the references in the big name texts I already knew about and kind of piecing them together. Coming into this, I stumbled into a paper from a historian named Patricia Crone called Kavod's Heresy and the Mazdakite Revolt. And in that, she discusses each individual source, including a lot of the untranslated Arabic sources that I don't even know how to access individually. So I was able to track through her references to kind of build up the narrative that I was constructing here.
How are Mazdak and his heresy viewed by modern Zoroastrians?
From my experience interacting with modern Zoroastrians, he is a background figure that's just kind of shorthand for heretic. More historically, up until really about the 19th century, he was the heretic. He is listed above the leaders of other religions. He's listed in some cases above literal Daiva, the demons of their religion. He's considered the worst. And it's not very clear why. That's one of the big lingering questions about him, of why he was so hated. What what reform was he preaching that was so upsetting to the establishment? Because nothing seems that radical or even that like it was implemented very much.
Yeah. So what is the relationship like, both historically and in the present, between Zoroastrianism and Islam?
So for in the present...
Big question,
it,
I know.
It really depends on where. You know, for the vast bulk of Zoroastrians today are in India and Iran, and the rest are a very dispersed diaspora. And in India, they spent most of history both being kind of minorities in the Northeast or the Northwest, and there wasn't much friction, unless Mumbai was being actively conquered, but that's just kind of the friction you get with any kind of fighting. In Iran, it has fluctuated dramatically, even just under the current Islamic Republic government. Right after the revolution, they cracked down really hard on other religions. In the last couple of decades, they've really loosened restrictions and kind of embraced Zoroastrianism's historical function as a element of their tourism policy. And I know there's been some concern from Zoroastrians in Iran that they're facing another crackdown with the most recent round of protest and uprising over there.
So we're just about out of time, but I wanted to give you a minute or so to plug any upcoming episodes that you're excited about.
Yes, I am just wrapping up the run on Alexander the Great. Well, on his conquest of Persia, I'm stuck with him for another 15 episodes. And this is the part where I get to make the fun announcement that in February, I'm going to be launching a second podcast that won't interrupt the first, but it's going to be called America Secret Wars. And it's going to go into all of the little conflicts that we try to write out of the history books.
Sounds cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming and speaking, Trevor. There's a lot of interesting chat going on, so I encourage you to take that back to the lobby chat and carry on with it. And
absolutely.
Everybody get ready for the next keynote.
Bye, everyone. Bye.
Thank you all for listening. I hope to hear from you this Saturday at Intelligent Speech. If not, the Almost War with Canada series will continue the next day. Until then, throw off the shackles of your imperial hegemon and convince your local monarch to become a communist.
Hey, History of Persia fans, before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.